Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
What does it mean to be Black in America? In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as Black experiences, you'll hear it means everything. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.
When she passed away, I was in college and I got a phone call from one of my aunts and she said, "I just heard your friend died." And I didn't know who she was talking about. And she was, I was like, "Who?" And she said, "Madeline Kahn." And she was right. That was my friend when I was young. She was my friend. That's who I spent my afternoons with after school and who I would watch all the time. I spent a lot of time with her.
Everyone's got their thing. Leave the knife, take the cannoli, guys. It's episode 9, Family Business. Guys, we're almost at the end of our Dexter time. I'm getting so sad, but I won't cry. Not yet. I'm one of your hosts, David Magadoff. With me is my wonderful, effervescent co-host, Miss Claire Kramer. Good morning, Claire Kramer.
Good morning, David. How are you?
Delightful, because we have on not only a wonderful guest today, I'm not going to say his name quite yet, but we have a wonderful episode for you. We're going to recap episode 9. We have on Mr. Michael Cyril Creighton later. Yes, Fred Jr. himself. You know him from Dexter, New Blood, Only Murders in the Building, High Maintenance, Game Night, The Post, of course, the Oscar-winning Spotlight. And he's going to talk about his love of Madeline Kahn. But we'll get to there. We'll get there. Okay, guys. Right now, we have on with us a very special guest, a dear friend of mine, the writer of episode 9, co-writer of episode 6, executive producer of Dexter New Blood, a writer of many, many, many of the seasons of Dexter. I think, darn it, maybe all of them. Peabody award-winning, Jessica Jones writing, Iron Fist writing, Inhumans even, Mr. Scott Reynolds. Hello, Scott Reynolds.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Yeah, that's quite an intro. I don't really know what you say after that. Just like, thank you.
Thanks a lot, man. I dig it.
King of the universe himself. So Scott, this was a very, very wonderful special episode. So we're going to start just talking about it ourselves. And then we're going to ask you how you made it so wonderful. Sound good?
I'm here.
Okay, great. Claire, what did you think of this amazing episode?
Wow. It was, you know what? It was satisfying. From a personal standpoint, David, you know why. You know why, because I finally
got the
confirmation that I was correct with the ring of ladies that he was preserving for his own. Now, I thought it was in the cave. It was not in the cave. It was in the underground hidden bunker. So that was a little bit of a surprise. And I love that Harrison used the drone to find, you know, used Mr. Caldwell's own gift against him, if you will.
The drone came back.
It all came back. When I saw the woman, I was very satisfied personally. Also, the fact that he did not view it as harming them. He was saving them. And we talked a lot about that with the character, you know.
What a great guy, right?
He truly felt he was doing the right thing, you know, which is also akin to Dexter and living the code, except Kurt, obviously, his code was never flushed out by his father. His father just created more harm than good in Kurt's life. So that being said, it was a satisfying episode. It was also really difficult for me to watch. I was into him teaching Harrison about the dark passenger, but I also, it was a difficult moment because Deb is right. You can't go back. Like once that is spoken, once that is said out loud, which, you know, Harry's the only one Dexter has ever talked to about the dark passenger other than Deb, you know, now that Deb is in his mind, it's once it's said, it's out there in the world. So I don't know, David, Scott. Tell me your thoughts on that.
I want to throw it to Scott, because Scott, you've done some of the most wonderful episodes of television in these moments. These episode nines, you handle so well. I still remember Jessica Jones with her and David Tennant just walking through that house. Yeah. You know how to handle these moments where you're like, how do you explain these things? How does a serial killer father who's finally reconnecting with his abandoned son finally, you know, speak to him about what he does in a way that is not incredibly terrible, but also maybe partly loving? And you handled it so well. How did you approach that?
I mean, every feeling that you were talking about there is exactly what we wanted. Mm-hmm. You know, that we were really going for that. Like, you're siding with Dexter because we've been with Dexter for nine years now, and you want him to like,
and a missing decade. So almost like two decades, you know?
Yeah. And he's welcomed us in. We've been just as guilty of everything that he's doing as he is, because we know it and we haven't done anything about it. You know what I mean? And he's talking to us all the time. So, we really wanted to, we had to fight our instincts a little bit, because, you know, part of us wanted to like, get to it, get the two of them together. But it just felt that having that presence of Deb in his brain always saying, don't do it. You can't unring this bell. You say this thing, it's all gonna just, you know, in small little steps. But then with Dexter saying, please ask me this next question, please, you know, and watching, you know, Dexter look at his son like he's a mirror, basically, you know, which is a sociopathic sort of thing.
Well, and that was exemplified really well in this episode. I mean, I think throughout the season, the hair and makeup have done a phenomenal job of like actual, and wardrobe, of making these guys look really like family, you know, the way they do the hair and the everything, the way that Harrison eats on camera is like so Dexter, you know, it's like so perfect that this episode, all that work, all that backstory, all that like little idiosyncrasies that the actors and the team put into mirroring these two it was a big payoff, I thought.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I love that scene of the two of them sitting on the back of the truck. Because if you watch it again, there's just little things that Jack is doing, because Jack's been watching Michael this whole season, and there's like a little rub on his leg, a little above his knee that they both do, the way they're both sort of sitting there, their posture, that they really are mirroring each other by that time. Even down to the caps, which happened on the day, because it was snowing so much that for continuity's sake, we had to put a cap on them, and it actually just enhanced that whole scene.
No, it totally worked. Yeah. And it was a great, like a beautiful accident, I guess you can say, because they really, the convergence, and now with Harrison, you know, watching Dexter in each step, he was, you know, Dexter kept checking in on him. Are you okay? Are you okay? Do you want to go up? Do you want to, you know, da, da, da. Yeah. And he's like, no, I'm good. It just was a big payoff to see them so similar in that moment.
And that moment when the most beautiful and horrific moment in the episode for me, and there's a lot of them, but is that moment when the camera's on Harrison, the way that Marcos Siega just and Hillary shot that moment down in that underground cavern, and Harrison says, "This motherfucker deserves to die," right? And then Dexter turns, Dexter looks at him and goes up and he kisses his son on the forehead and hugs him. And it's like the darkest moment, but also the most beautiful moment. It encompasses all of these feelings that we're having of like, do it, don't do it, please, you know?
Right.
What's so special is it's the first time that Dexter has someone that he, a real person, not someone in his head, who he can trust, and who says, I'm okay with this. And maybe we can do this together, because he's always been doing it by himself. And
this is what he's wanted his whole life. Wow. I mean, that's what we all want, right? We all want to belong. We all want to become something.
We want our children. We want our offspring to understand us, like more than anything, you know?
Claire has four kids, Scott. So this is,
we're like these alien beings, like trying to do right by them, trying to raise them, you know, and eventually—
Hoping
like,
they don't hate us.
Yeah, hoping they don't hate us. Like, I'm prepared for my kids to hate me for the next decade. It's okay. But, you know, eventually I want them to come around like Harrison has and be like, I get you. Like, I get you. I get you. all your mistakes, all your idiosyncrasies, your dark passenger, everything. The moment for me, Scott, where I was like, wow, there is no going back, is after, you know, that great scene where the blood is trickling down from Kurt and he has the flashbacks with Rita in the bathtub. And then he goes up top and you're kind of like, okay, he needs a break. That's cool. Harrison fully needs a break. So what does Dexter do? He opens that hatch and he's like, hey, put these body bags of Kurt in the back of the ATV. And I'm like, oh my God, Dexter fully has lost. He has lost touch with the kills so much that now that he has someone on the inside, he doesn't realize, like, I am handing my son like limbs of of the first person he's seen.
This comes from my own life where I don't chop up bodies and all that. But but that I often make that mistake of, like, when someone says I'm fine, I go, okay.
Yeah.
And I don't read, you know, I'm married. I've been married for like 26 years now. And there's often times where I don't read the room in the correct way that, you know, we've had discussions where I'm like, listen, just tell me. Because if you say I'm fine, then I'm like, okay, great. Here's the dead bodies, you know.
Right, and that is exactly what Dexter did.
Yeah.
Okay, so who left the note? Is that from Molly, the note in Bishop's mailbox when...
He can't say yet. Well, this is a spoiler,
let's
killer.
Let's talk about it. Somebody talk about it with me. That's why I'm here, to talk about, like, these moments. So, David, pretend you don't know.
Well, what helps is I don't remember the scripts as well as I should. I should, because it's been months. Well, I guess I remember the scripts as well as I should. It's been months. So I do get to sort of watch it with new eyes. I'm like watching that going, oh yeah, who did write that note?
It's funny. It wasn't supposed to be a mystery in our heads when we wrote it. Like, it's...
Oh.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, is it Kurt?
I think it's Kurt. Like, I think Kurt dropped
it. Did Kurt
off
do it? Is that
kind
died
of a final... Yeah, it's a final FU from Kurt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It could be. You know, it's interesting you think it's Molly. Then you have to ask the question of, like, why would Molly write a note like that to...
I don't think Molly would.
Because she'd be like... This
She's
is,
like,
you know,
let's go get some, this, let's have some whiskey and talk about this.
That's exactly right. Yeah. How do I turn this into my story? How do I grind this into something that's going to entertain the masses, you know?
By the way, I fully think that the Showtime team should create the Mary Fucking Kill podcast, because I would listen to it. I actually went on iTunes. I was like, how genius would it be if they were actually publishing episodes of this podcast?
And we did.
It's out there. I haven't found it. I need to find it.
Yeah, I'll send it to you guys. Yeah, okay,
Scott. Great. Also, you're the genius behind the Logan breakup playlist, if I am correct.
That's right. Yeah.
Which you can get on Spotify, which is amazing.
Yeah. We've tried to make our podcast very interactive in that way. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. So, Scott, you've been at the helm of this wonderful Dexter wrap up podcast. Yes, pun intended. since what season, Scott? I know we just brought
it back. Started it season seven and eight. And when we did it, we were like the first TV show to...
Yeah.
There's lots of podcasts
Chris
about
Hardwick
TV shows.
And Talking Dead or... Yeah.
It was way before that.
Yeah.
It was fun. And, you know, people were sort of like, I guess, you know, they were sort of like, if you want to do it, sure, I guess.
And now it's like one of the most popular, you know, TV podcasts out there. So congrats to that.
Yeah.
Did you approach Showtime with that idea?
I did.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm way into getting as much out there as you can. Like, it can't hurt. And the fans are hungry for it, you know?
And you deliver it.
What is your favorite part? You've been with this character a long time. What is your favorite part about Dexter Morgan?
Good question. What is my favorite part about Dexter Morgan? I guess it really comes down to his voiceover. The way that he says the things in his head that we think. And that's why we love him so much. I also love his code. I'm a big Westerns fan. I'm a big crime movie fan.
Mm-hmm.
And all the best versions of those are these stories about men with a code, you know, and what happens when the rest of the world doesn't live up to this person's code.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's like Robert Mitchum and Man with a Gun, or it's, you know, Parker movies, whatever. It's all there. And Dexter really feeds that part of me in the best of ways. And also just the way that it's able to be so funny and dark.
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk about the comedy and the darkness for a second? Because this is where you and I intersect so well. And I adore your writing in that way, because you do handle something that can be so tough and dark and intense and moody. And at the same time, all of a sudden these, you know, serial killer and serial killer's son are wearing the goofiest Christmas sweaters you've ever seen. And, you know, you make, you gave Teddy some of his funnier lines, and it's just great to see that. Do you try actively to put the comedy in, or do you think it naturally comes as you're typing it out?
Yeah, I'm never thinking, oh, I need a joke here. It just sort of happens. It just sort of comes out of the situation. And that, you know, and oftentimes in the room, like lots of people pitch in on jokes. So there's lots of times when, you know, I'll write in a joke that's okay, not a joke, but like a funny moment. And someone will be like, you know, it'd be really funny. And they'll be like, that is really funny. And you know, that's how things just get better and sharper. And that's the beauty of writing in a room, you know? Like Wiggles, man. Wiggles is the darkest and the funniest opening. That's my favorite opening of Dexter ever. Yeah.
Why?
The whole sequence.
I mean, it's great, but I like you're saying of all the episodes, I'd love to hear why.
Yeah. Well, because we've been away from that Dexter for so long. It was
classic Dexter. The moment the episode started, I was like, ah, here we go. I know what's happening now. You know, he's going in, finding his proof, and then I know what's going to happen next. It was very satisfying as a viewer.
That's great. Yeah. And it was Marcos and Hillary, who are our director and DP, who said, you know what, we're going to switch the aspect ratio and we're going to go back to the old version, the full, you know, it almost feels like full screen on our big wide TVs, and changing the color and make them all desaturated and bright and shiny like it is again. Yeah, it just felt like, and I had to fight for it, like, you know, budget started getting in the way and people started going, you know, well, what we can do is just sort of do like best of versions of his kills, and he could talk about all these kills that he's done. And I just kept going, you know, listen, this is not that story. This is a parent telling a truth in quotations about their life in a way that's going to make them look bright and shiny and awesome, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of true and it's kind of not true. There's, you know.
Yeah.
But it's true to Dexter.
And when Harrison says, you're kind of like Batman, that may have been my favorite line of the entire series, like ever. It was just so like on the nose, but not. And you could see like Michael C. Hall was like,
I prefer the Dark Defender, which is like a callback from the old show. Like,
exactly.
It was an episode about the comic books, and someone started doing a comic book about the Bay Harbor Butcher, and they called him the Dark Defender.
Mm-hmm.
When Michael is looking at the camera, was that you writing those moments in, or yes. Marcos's choice? It was you.
No, that was
great.
I put those in. Like, it was very, because now he really is. We finally get to settle into Dexter Morgan as a storyteller. You know, like, there's lots of conjecture about the voiceover and its purpose and why it's there. You know, is he talking to, you know, back in the day we were like, is he talking to someone on death row? Is he actually just talking to us? Are these just his thoughts? You know, there's lots of arguments and thoughts and wild swings about why he's doing this. And this was sort of, for me, this was the opportunity to like really go like, no, this is Dexter telling a story to someone. Mm-hmm. And right now it is to his son. I just love the moment when Harrison's voice interrupts the storytelling, and you're sort of like, wait, what's going on? And then we pop into the cabin, and it's all warm and the fire's glowing behind, and this father and son are just having this like heart to heart about murder.
Murder.
Yeah. I can't believe we have to wrap up, but we do. Speaking of wrap ups, Claire, what do you think's happening in the finale? We got one episode left. What do you think, Claire?
David and Scott, I don't know. Storyline is tied up. It's really going to be about if Dexter is able to and chooses to reveal himself to the other person in his life who he has shown intimacy, which is, of course, his girlfriend. You know, she is on to him, and how far he's going to take his quote-unquote partnership with his son Harrison. So it's really, it's about, we're still in the triangulation of relationships, but it's changed from Kurt, Dexter, Harrison to Harrison, Dexter, Bishop.
That's good assessment. Right.
That's
good assessment.
That's where I'm going with it. I'm excited to see the finale. I really am. But also sad because it means it's over.
Yeah. All I'll say is Vincent Van Gogh is, it's a big moment for him in the finale.
Yeah, I'm hoping so.
Yeah. Scott, thank you so much for joining us. It was an absolute pleasure. Everyone, please
Scott, you're a legend.
listening, if you're listening to this and you somehow are not listening to the wrap up with Scott Reynolds, I don't know how that's possible, but please, for the three of you left, do that. And we are thrilled to have on.
You should definitely check it out for the finale, because we're going to have Michael C. Hall, Jack Alcott, and Clyde, and talking all about the whole thing. Mark and Alex also, who are co-writers on the finale. So it'll be great.
And maybe Vincent Van Gogh.
And I love your guys' podcast, by the way. That the horror film poster one is my favorite.
Oh, yeah. Michael Rosenbaum. He's great.
Yeah. I was like, I want to see his collection.
He has quite the collection. And we have another Michael on today for the episode of Fanatics.
That's right.
Michael Searle Creighton, Fred Jr. Good. Himself. Hilarious. We got so friendly, him and I, and we text every week. He's just makes me laugh and smile. And he's currently filming season two of Only Murders in the Building. Guys,
such a good show.
If you love him in this show, go watch Only Murders in the Building for a million reasons, one of them being Michael Searle Creighton. All right, let's deep dive in with Madeline Kahn. Enjoy.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Michael, when you meet somebody who doesn't know who Madeline Kahn is, what reaction do you have?
I feel pretty happy because then I get to talk about her a lot and sort of share my favorite thing with someone. I'm a little aghast. I'm going to be honest, I'll be a little aghast. But, you know, she died several, you know, decades ago. So there are young people who probably have no exposure to her. But I get excited because I get to talk about her. I always start with like my first movie that I saw of hers, which is Clue. And that was my entrance point, even though it was sort of later in her career, more mid-career. I explain that they have to watch Clue. Everything about Clue is perfect. Madeline Kahn is the most perfect part of Clue. And then I go backwards. And then if we get real deep, I'll get into the musicals that she did and sort of her career on Broadway and some of her heartaches and things. And it's always a dream to talk about her. So I would say I give my top three favorites, Clue, Paper Moon, and What's Up, Doc, are my three top favorite movies. And then I'll delve into, you know, more ephemera.
And okay, so Michael, for those people who don't know Madeline Kahn,
right?
Can you just give an overview explanation, the Cliff Note version of who she is as a person and as an artist?
Absolutely. So she is a comedic actress, or was a comedic actress, who was trained in opera and sort of landed in movies, which I don't think is where she ended up. Thought she was going to end up going. She went to Hofstra for opera and then ended up doing film, doing theater. And she was sort of a singular voice, just a completely unique comedic actress. And just brought so much to everything she did. Even when it was a tiny little part, she made every single moment count and added value to every single project she was in. She was beautiful and funny and hilarious and gorgeous and had the best voice. And that's how I would probably pitch her to people.
And she's right behind you. There's this amazing painting behind you right now of her from Clue with the wonderful black-haired bob and her necklace and her cut-off shoulders.
Yeah.
And I love that that was the movie that you first learned about her. I think that was the movie I first learned about her, too, and loved her so much. And Flames, Flames Out of My Head. Oh, my gosh.
It's the best. Hilarious. Yeah, I remember renting the video. We had a video store in my town called Chicken Video, and I was probably, because they did fried chicken and videos, and perfect pairing. And I was probably 8 or 9, I think, and I remember seeing the copy of the VHS and just being drawn to it, specifically her picture on the VHS. And one of my aunts rented it for me. I thought it was pretty scary at first because it is a little bit dark for an 8 or 9 year old. But then I slowly memorized it. And as soon as she entered the frame, as soon as she was on screen, I felt really safe because there was this sort of quality that she has that's, she's just very comforting to me. She always has been. I don't know why. I can't really explain it, but there's something about the quality of her voice, the flutter of her eyelids, the way she does a line reading, which, I mean, at 8, I didn't know what a line reading was, but, you know, it just, it really comforts me, and I feel very connected to her.
With that first VHS experience, how many times did you watch the movie before you had to return it, or were you able to convince your aunt to purchase it for you?
Oh, we didn't purchase it, but I would get it every week, probably. I definitely watched it the first week. I think we were allowed to keep it for a week. I definitely watched it at least once a day, probably twice on the weekend. And then I delve into the other VHSs. There was this, she actually was my introduction into Saturday Night Live because my Chicken Video had a VHS of her performance on Saturday Night Live, her hosting gig from 1976. And it was so funny. And there's so many killer sketches in it. So I rented that one a lot as well. And then I ended up buying it from Chicken Video when they closed. So I have that in my house.
I got to find that hosting episode that she did. That's my immediate Google after this.
It's great. Her and Gilda Radner together are sort of just incredible. And they do Barbara Walters and Marlena Dietrich. They do impressions. Madeline does an impression of a baby eating ice cream for the first time. And that's what Gilda Radner does. And then Madeline does an impression of a parakeet learning how to say hello, Madeline. It's really great.
How good was the fried chicken? Be real.
I mean, I think with no exposure to other fried chicken at the time, I think it was pretty good. I think if I went back in time, I'd be like, this is soggy and disgusting. But there was something great about being able to just one-stop shop, you know, get your dinner and get the mashed potatoes were good. They also had mashed potatoes. Oh. So I remember them.
So now let's fast forward a couple decades. How often in your life, Michael, like today, will you watch a Madeline video or a VHS or a sketch or so pull it up on the internet, anything like that?
I would say at least once a month, I'll do like a quick YouTube search, see if there's anything I haven't seen or that I've missed. And then my go-to sort of comfort video of hers or performance of hers that I find inspiring, especially if I'm working on something, because it's just incredibly perfect timing, execution. It's this monologue she does in Paper Moon where she's on the top of the hill. She's playing Trixie Delight and she's talking to Tatum O'Neill. And it's this really great monologue that sort of surfs all of the emotions. And it's just this really perfect performance. Funny, heartbreaking, just there's a lot to it. So I'll watch that every now and then to be like, oh, that's how it's done. That's how you do it. That's how you make a small speech last, you know?
Do you think you connect more with her as a person or an artist or like the combination of the two?
That's a really good question. I think initially I thought as an artist, or I was just drawn to her because I was always drawn to, she was my first character actress that I got drawn to. And that's been a constant throughout my whole life. I just love female actresses of a certain age. But so I was like a fan of her work. And then as I've gotten older and watched interviews with her and read things that her husband has said about her, I feel like I relate to her on a personal level and also the way she works more than I would have ever known. Like, She said on one of her interviews that she always tries to find the darkness under the humor and the humor under the darkness. And that's really important to her. And it's only important to her. It's not that it's something that anybody needs to know. That's something I always think about. She also often talks about how she couldn't follow the herd. She was going to have to do it on her own. And she was a lot of times in her own head, which could be very lonely, which I feel is very relatable. And I think in many ways, there's a lot of myself I see in her now that I know about her that drew me to her. And I didn't even know it. You know what I mean? Like, I read her biography and I was like, oh, this all makes sense. And I would have had no idea otherwise. You know, she's hard on herself. She's a perfectionist. She doesn't understand why people are laughing when she's being funny. She transmits sort of, she talks about how she can't help that her look and her voice and her package transmits a certain message, and people pick up comedic vibes from her, whether she means it or not. I can relate to that. But, you know, she would do anything for, not do anything for a laugh, but she was so funny and also so serious. And I think that's such an interesting combination of a person. So I think I relate to her on a personal level more than I ever thought.
That's so cool. Is this something where, because I'm a huge Madeleine Kahn fan, not to your level, but I've also had a secret place in my heart for her, because whenever she's on screen, whether it be, you know, we'll get to all the movies and, you know, Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein and Clue and beyond, she's always the scene stealer. Is this something that you keep to yourself? Is this something that you share with other people? Have you found other Madeleine Kahn fans? Is this something that everyone who knows you like Madeleine Kahn? Or is it, no, this is more kind of just in your little late nights or early mornings, just the thing that you do?
No, I think it's everybody who knows me knows I love Madeleine Kahn. I mean, that painting that's behind me that you see, my husband got made for me for our fifth anniversary many years ago. And I got it turned into a phone case. I have a Madeleine Kahn pin on my jacket. It's more like a brooch. I'm not ashamed to admit it. Everyone I know knows that she is my number one. I never get tired of talking about how much I love her. She's never not comforted me when I watch her. When she passed away, I was in college and I got a phone call from one of my aunts, and she said, I just heard your friend died. And I didn't know who she was talking about. And she was, I was like, who? And she said, Madeleine Kahn. And she was right. That was my friend when I was young. She was my friend. That's who I spent my afternoons with after school and who I would watch all the time. Like, I spent a lot of time with her. Yeah. So people know. I mean, it's no big secret. I'm not in any sort of online community. I do love talking about her with other people, people who knew her. I've had many people in my life that have had contact with her or had seen her live. And that is very cool to get sort of some insight of people who knew her personally.
So someone who knows her personally or knew her personally before mm-hmm. she passed away, what aspect do you want to know most about her personality? Is it how she went through her daily life, daily activities? Is it how she prepared for a role? What do you ask that person who was close with her?
Well, one of my managers was her agent at one point in the later part of her career. And I'll just sit down and be like, just tell me a story. Just tell me any Madeleine story. And it usually is about like how kind she was and how funny she was and how great she was to visit on Fire Island and things like that. And that's nice to know that someone I like so much liked her so much as a person. And then when I hear, like I had a friend who saw tapings of Cosby when she was on Cosby, long silence.
She was great on that.
She was incredible on that. And apparently he was at a taping of it and she had this bit with a pen. And every single time this bit with the pen was different and longer and wilder. And she just brought everyone to pieces and but was totally serious the whole time. So it's really cool to hear that. I wish I had seen her live. I could have had the chance. I was in New York when, you know, I grew up on Long Island, so I was in high school when she was performing in musicals or not musicals, but like concerts and the Sisters Rose and Sway, which she won the Tony for. I could have seen those, and it kills me that I didn't. But sometimes maybe it's better not to see your idol. Now, every time I go to Lincoln Center where they have the Have you been, David, down to the theater downstairs ever at Lincoln Center?
Where but you have to show me when we go to the...
Oh, yeah.
When we do the Dexter premiere. I don't know when this episode... this episode will air before or after the Dexter premiere, but that's where we're going to be. So
okay. Well,
you could show me personally.
Amazing. Downstairs in the theater, there's all these pictures on the wall of productions, and there's a giant picture of Madeleine Kahn and Jane Alexander and Frances McDormand, maybe. And every time I go see a play at Lincoln Center, I put my hand on Madeleine and just say hi. I mean, it's good that you asked me to talk about this, David, because it really is the thing that I am the most fanatical about.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So when you touch her photo, and I've been to that theater many times, so I know the images you're talking about. Now I can't wait to go look at for that image. But when you touch when you touch her, what feeling, like what goes through your body? What goes through your mind when you have your hand at Lincoln Center on her photo?
I just get chills. It's like I never got why people would like go and visit grave sites of people they loved or anything. It's not something that I would want to do, but there is something about it's, it feels, I'm not a religious person or a spiritual person per se, but it does feel like a little connection or just a little, maybe for a moment I'm saying hello and you can hear me. And maybe you, maybe she knows that she really added so much value to my life.
Your aunt calling you up and saying your friend passed is probably, I think we were only, 30 episodes of maybe we've recorded sort of in our can. I got a little, like, my heart, like, I got a little teary. Almost more that your aunt is so sweet that she was so thoughtful to know that you have such a sweet relationship, to be seen that way. I actually thought that was incredibly sweet. And that she sees you. I think we should all have an aunt like your aunt.
Yeah. I got three of them, which is nice. You
amazing.
Know, they all.
Is there a scene of hers that exudes her genius to you that maybe stands out maybe above the rest, or at least one that pops in your mind right
now? Yeah. I mean, the one that's like a standout, I got to give three. I'm sorry. The one that I talked about was the monologue on the hill in Paper Moon. Mm-hmm. Is just perfect execution, really in the moment. I've read a lot about the filming of that, and there were certain words she didn't want to say because she was actually quite prudish in real life, and how she kind of fought the director a little bit and being like, I don't want to say tits, but and then she does in the final take, and it's of course perfect. I think that's a perfect execution. Everything she does in Clue is always going to be my number one favorite just because it's my first. But her performance in What's Up, Doc, which is her first movie, it's a, like the introducing Madeleine Kahn in the bottom, is really amazing and has always been an inspiration to me as an actor because she makes an incredibly unlikable character, sort of this very annoying woman, so likable and so funny. So her performance as Eunice Burns, I think, is in the top there for me.
Can you describe, can you, without going into like a 25 minute detail, could you take someone through a moment with of Madeleine
in, as like Eunice
one
Burns
of your favorite moments?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So she plays a very shrill housewife who is always in sort of unflattering clothes and sort of a ridiculous wig. And in the movie, Ryan O'Neill sort of becomes friends and is seduced by Barbara Streisand. Barbara Streisand steals Eunice Burns' badge so she can come into a dinner with them. And Eunice is trying to get into the dinner. And she says, we have a Eunice Burns here. And she's like, I am not a Eunice Burns. I am the Eunice Burns. And she has a complete meltdown at the counter and then gets dragged out of the banquet hall screaming, Howard, Howard Bannister, Howard Bannister. And it's just her, the pitch of her voice could be so annoying in anyone else's mouth and in most people's ears. But to me, it's like music. You know what I mean? It's just, she knows how to do it.
She had a master and control of her voice. I'm even speaking slowly, kind of thinking of her, because she just knew how to eke out a comedic moment. And she knew how to play with her voice. She did. That voice would go high and low, and she would play, and it's beautiful. It really is a work of art, and someone who you're thankful she did opera, because that made her so hilarious. And what a treat to know that.
Exactly. Her voice is like an instrument, and then there's so much musicality to all of her performances. Those are my favorites.
Do you think you connect with her a little bit because, and maybe this is me just projecting myself into your world, Michael, and Madeline's.
Please do.
But you connect with her because as an artist, like sometimes we're able to express ourselves in very different ways on camera or on stage than we are ever in our personal life, ever in our real life. And like, you know, I know for me, I'm much freer as when I'm, you know, playing a character and have the confines of, you know, a story and a script. And in a way, it's an emotional release. Do you think that's part of the connection that you have with her?
I think so. Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. Because even in reading about her and how she treated her work and treated herself, I find there's a lot of overlap as far as how we approach things. And in, for example, in What's Up, Doc, she said that what she was doing and what she saw on screen were completely different. She thought she was going to look beautiful, but they filmed her from below a lot. She looked, in her mind, rather chubby. She gave a performance that had no vanity whatsoever. It was like fearless and wild and hilarious. But then when she saw it afterwards, really, I saw her on an interview with Rosie O'Donnell. She said, the day after I saw the premiere, I called a therapist and I started therapy because it was so overwhelming for her. She did not like seeing herself. She was a vain person in her personal life, but on screen she was not, but it was hard for her to watch herself. I understand that. Yeah. A fun fact about that, and I do know that I sound like an idiot savant with her, but she, because of What's Up, Doc, and because she was playing, came off very frumpy looking, she got cast in MAME with Lucille Ball, the movie musical of MAME, as Agnes Gooch. And when she got to the table read, she was this redheaded bombshell. She was not at all what Lucy saw in What's Up, Doc. And after the table read, Lucy fired her. Apparently, that's the story. So she is not in the movie. But that opened the way for her to do Blazing Saddles. So everything happens for a reason, right? But
oh my gosh.
Yeah.
We rarely get into the craft, but because your fanaticism is kind of connected to what you do. And let's just use Only Murders in the Building because it's also, one, it's a nice plug. And two, it's on Hulu, Steve Martin, Michael's wonderful in it. Are you pulling from her at all when you're doing your thing? Like the scene where you're crying in, I believe it's the pilot episode, right?
Oh, the second episode at the board meeting, yeah.
Like that's almost Madeline Kahn-esque in my eyes, just the way that you play that off. Does that pop in your head when you're doing it, or is it more that you just maybe love her so much and that you just like, yeah, my style of doing comedy sort of blends with her? Or is it inspired by, or is it just parallel?
I think it's inspired by. I would never like approach a job or a script and be like, I want to do this like Madeline Kahn. But like I said, the stuff about finding the darkness under the humor and vice versa, I do try to approach stuff that way as she did. So I think it would be the greatest honor of my life to be compared to her in any way. I don't think I'm intentionally drawing from her, but she's in my DNA in many ways, just because I watch her so much.
As many great actors are. Like, we are inspired by those that are good at their craft. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whether it's a painter, like this, you know, what we hang on our walls or what we watch. Of course, it's you know, it's going to happen. She's going to influence your work. And my acting teacher at Strasbourg in New York City used to say, if you like a performance, steal from it. Steal everything. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Why not? If you could insert yourself in one of her projects, would it be Clue? And who would you play? Or Ooh. Any of her?
Oh, God. Oh, that's a really good question. I think it would have to be one of the plays, because then I would have gotten to spend more time with her. Although she did quit plays quite a bit. But I would say I would want to be in, I would want to watch a rehearsal process with her. That would be what would really get me super jazzed, is to watch her process and then get to perform with her. I would say maybe, oh, wow, that's a hard one. But I think maybe on the 20th Century, even though she left that, I don't sing. I mean, I could never be in it. I don't sing. It was a million years ago. But if I could jump into that process,
it's and a see hypothetical, because
like
she is dead. I do want to remind you.
Yes. No.
I'm
why
sorry.
Are you being so mean?
Sorry.
You're right. I would say, Claire, you're breaking my heart. I think I would do, on the 20th Century, just so I could watch that rehearsal process and see what it was like and be there for her recording the album. And I think there'd be a lot of bang for my buck in that situation.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah.
Is it important if your husband likes Madeline Kahn, and does he?
He does. I think he's not in any way my level. I think he appreciates her. We have enjoyed watching her work together. He never is like, oh, please turn that off if she's on. He knows how important she is to me. He did get that painting made for me. He's very supportive of my love. If he didn't like her, I think that would be a real challenge. If he actively hated Madeline Kahn, I don't know how we would have stayed together this long.
I hear you.
You know?
So, Michael, I loved getting to this point, and you kind of touched on it just a little bit early on, and I think this is why, like, if you ask me why I love Fanatics, it's for this moment. And so you did say it early on, like, I'm not sure why it is that I have such a connection to her. I mean, obviously you played with the idea that, yes, there's a lot of her comedic styling that you see in yourself, and also her life that you see in her in yourself, and at the more you learned about her. But let's dig into it a little bit. Like, you know, when I've thought about the things that I love, it's funny, it connects to either maybe a home life or things with my parents or whatever. Is there something that, if you did have to dig a little bit now, why her? Why in this time of your life? Why in that moment in your life? Like, was it at the age that we were watching Clue, and why are you?
Yeah, I mean, I think good question. And I think that it has to do, I've talked about this with other fans of hers. I think it has a lot to do with being gay and sort of being a young age and seeing, being attracted to, in a way, to this woman's glamour and her cadence and her costume and her lipstick. And like, just like, you know, she says that costume in Clue made her feel like Judy Garland, and there's nothing gayer than that. But you know, like, I think at a young age, not knowing what made me or what I was learning, what I responded to, it was my first introduction to a diva, in a way, in sort of my big gay crush. And it's just been one of the very few things that I've stuck with, you know, for decades and decades and decades and decades. You know, she's just been around forever. And I think that's probably part of it, you know?
When was the last time you learned a new tidbit of information about her?
Let's see. It might have been on her birthday this year. It was the 29th of September, and someone posted something about her husband said that when she would be asked to do commencement speeches, she would always tell the students about a time that she went to SeaWorld, and she would see this big group of seals that everybody was crowded around and, you know, feeding them. And there was always this one seal over by the side, and every now and then someone would come and bring it food. And it was able to live, and, you know, it got a little attention here and there, and then they go away. And that's how she felt. She saw herself as that seal. And that was her way of telling the students not to follow the herd. Sort of sometimes you just got to do it on your own, which I thought, you know, it is like every time I read something new about her, I'm like, well, that makes perfect sense that I'm so obsessed with her. It really just does. Yeah, I love her.
Oh, that's so great. Yeah. I love that. For someone who's never seen her or has known about her or even knew the words Madeline Kahn existed before this episode, what would you tell them, which movie or even a scene to watch if they just had to do a quick YouTube and or, hey, watch this movie, rent it?
Yeah, what would I say? Watch.
What's the first? What's the intro?
The very first is Clue. It has to be. It just has to be because it's like everything about Clue is so great. And it's incredible that she stands out in a movie filled with such an incredible ensemble who, I mean, I could do another one of these about Eileen Brennan for hours. But like, it's just, you know, there's just, that's the one, because all the ingredients to me, and it wasn't a hit at all when it came out, but all the ingredients just work so well. And it is a bunch of weird characters, character actors all together, working together. But somehow she was my phoenix for that. And I would say that's the one that you'd have to start with and then go backwards and then move forward. And then absolutely end with her last movie, which was this small indie film called Judy Berlin with Edie Falco and Anne Meara. Just an incredible cast, black and white, about a little town on Long Island during an eclipse. And it was probably just a few years before her death. I think it was making the festival circuit when she died. It sort of shows you where she was going. And it was this really beautiful, funny, sad performance of a lonely housewife on Long Island during an eclipse. And it makes me sad when I watch that one, because it's like you could see where she was moving. And I just can't even imagine what else she would have done. Like what she would be doing now, you know, there's so much, it seems like her talents would be really utilized in this sort of streaming world.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Because she died pretty young, like late 50s, right?
Yeah, 57.
57, yeah. That's young.
Too young. Too young.
Too
and
young.
And also just like was in a new phase of her career, like doing an indie film in your late 50s at that time in 90 something was a big risk. And she, I've heard that she was the happiest she ever was on that set. So that's a really good one, which is really hard to find, but Judy Berlin, black and white, really, really one of her best performances as well.
I would probably, I know I asked the question, but I'm not the fanatic for her, but I do like her a lot. I would say, just do a quick YouTube of I'm Tired. I'm so tired from
Blazing
Saddles.
Yeah, that's so perfect.
Just her song. That's what I would have recommended.
Take
Michael's advice.
No, that one's really perfect. That is a good one. And the way she got that job is because she sang at Brauhauses when she was in college to make money. So she knew those German beer songs. And then when she got fired from MAME, she heard they were doing that. She had a meeting with Mel Brooks. And I actually was just watching an interview with him the other day. And he said, well, I need to see your legs. I have to see your legs because they're very featured. And she like, you know, pulled her skirt up, showed him her legs. She's like, my legs are fabulous. She started speaking in the German accent and it was like a sealed deal. And it became this great, bountiful relationship between the both of them.
So great.
That is awesome.
Michael, can you please close us out with a beautiful love letter to your friend?
I would love to. Dear Madeline, thank you so much for everything. Thank you for being my constant, my number one favorite person to view at all times, at all, you know, different times in my life, the good and the bad. I can always count on you to cheer me up, make me happy, make me smile. I think of you as my guardian angel in many ways. I wish that I had seen you live, but I'm so glad your work lives on and I get to see it whenever I want on YouTube. And Gosh, you were the best. And I really just love you. Thank you. Was that
love
okay?
Michael.
Love Michael.
Love Michael.
Love Michael.
I thought it was.
I think that was more than okay. Okay.
It was fantastic.
Yeah.
Thanks.
And you know what? I am not tired. I am energized from this beautiful conversation. So thank you. I think what's so cool, I knew Michael loved Madeline Kahn before this conversation, which is why I was so excited to have him on for this. But I didn't know how much he loved Clue specifically. And the fact that he's in Only Murders in the Building, Steve Martin and Martin Short show, it's such a cool thing that he kind of manifested his own version of being in his own Clue, because it's a very Clue-like show, and you should all watch it. It's a great show on Hulu. I think that's pretty cool that he's kind of Madeline Conning his own destiny.
I love that. I haven't seen Murders yet, but I have heard very good things about it, and I intend on watching it, and now I intend to do a back-to-back with Clue first and then start the series because my kids haven't seen Clue yet. So that must happen.
Clue's so good. His talking about Clue so much reminds me, yes, Madeline Kahn. It's a stage play as a movie almost because you have Tim Curry and
Leslie Ann Warren.
Martin Mull.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really heck of a Christopher Lloyd. It's a beautifully done comedy that shouldn't have been a hit, wasn't a hit, but is now, thankfully, these last, I feel like 10 years, almost social media has brought people more attention to Clue. I love those movies that grow in time. And Madeline Kahn really is, you know, something that he spoke to that I want to speak to too, which I love as well, is she is such a bombastic personality, but is also so small and knows herself and is a powerful force. And it's a reminder that you can be so comfortable in your own skin, and really reminds me that as well. And that you can be so comfortable in your own skin and so grounded and so wonderful and hilarious. Like, you don't have to do a lot to get the laughs. And I think that's a nice life lesson too that I took away from the convo.
Yes, that is. I agree with you. You don't have to do a lot to get the laughs, but she also wasn't afraid to do a lot. That's what makes her such a genius actress, is she could play the whole spectrum. You know what I mean?
She would do what needed to be done when it needed to be done, but she wasn't just throwing it all against the wall. I think that's perfect, Claire. She knew when to make a big, fun moment out of a scream, out of a screech, out of a dance move, out of a physical thing. But usually that only was so funny because she was mostly so, even keel and grounded. So when she made a move, it mattered.
It was a big move. Does she have a star on the Walk of Fame?
We're going to do a post Google on this, a post convo Google. I hope she does. And if not, I hope we get to be the reason.
I mean, we talked about Gilda Radner. I know she does. And I mean, you know, they are similar in some ways, I guess. But, you know, she definitely deserves one and needs one because, you know, everything from Paper Moon to Clue to the last project that Michael was talking about, which I have not seen. I'm going to look it up. The black and white film she did, the indie film. You know, I mean, she's amazing. So, but my issue is, like, the Walk of Fame stars, it's kind of like a, I don't know. It's like a purchase process. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't know if she has a fan group around now other than Michael, you know, who is keeping her memory well alive. But I don't know if there's like a group that, you know, could initiate that because it's
Listen, if Californians can come together to try to recall a governor, we can get a petition list to get Madeline Kahn on the Walk of Fame. I believe.
But it's also about the money. That's where it becomes convoluted. You know what I mean?
I'm ready. I'm ready to spend. I'm ready. I got my wallet.
Can you pay in Bitcoin? That's the question.
Yeah, I was going to make the joke. I was like, I got my Bitcoin address.
Let's do it.
Make it happen.
Yes.
Guys, thanks so much again for listening. We are on this Dexter journey with you. We have so much more goodness to come. And we'll see you next Monday.
And wrapping up the Dexter episodes next week, we have Dexter's son himself, Jack Alcott, coming on. Yes, Harrison. He is going to be coming on and talking about his fanaticism for bowling. So it is definitely an episode not to be missed. We'll see you guys next week.
Thank you for listening to Fanatics, a Roddenberry podcast. For more episodes and info, head over to wearefanatics.com or tweet your Fanatics thoughts and stories at @WeAreFanatics.
Yes, that's We Are Fanadicts. Our show is hosted by Claire Kramer and me, David Magadoff.
Produced by me, Claire Kramer, and Kelsey Goldberg. Executive producers Trevor Roth and Rod Roddenberry.
Our sound engineer and editor is Elizabeth Joy Windham. And you can thank Stephen Mudd for our theme song.
Catch us next Thursday for another Fanatics episode.
Flames
on the side of my face.
I said flames
all over the place. We love you, Madeline.